Looks like we're running a few minutes early, but I think we have our lawyers for the next case. The next case on our calendar for oral argument is Lowe versus Landis and Twin Express Incorporated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals on this blustery winter day. I'm glad everyone made it safely.
The last appeal I had was a snowstorm, too.
Last one.
It's my fault.
Last one was by Zoom, so.
Well, we're happy to be back in person. It just was more challenging to get us all here today. But welcome. While you're getting settled, I'll remind you of what you likely already know, and that you will each have 15 minutes to make your argument this morning. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because they are being recorded. And you may either use the podium closest to you if you wish to maintain more distance, or you can use the center podium where the lighting is, and you can raise or lower that podium to suit your needs. So with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's nice to be here in person, finding metal detectors and new places to speak from. A lot of our argument is in our brief, so I don't know that there's a lot to add to it. To me, the more I've thought about this, the question here is whether and what's the judge's role as a gatekeeper on bringing cases in.
Did you identify yourself for
the
record?
Oh, I did not.
Okay.
I was so happy.
I couldn't remember.
I was so happy to be here.
I know, me too.
Michael Bryant, representing the plaintiff, David Lowe.
Thank you.
Did you come from the St. Cloud area?
Yes.
How was 94?
94 was better than the other roads. It was well traveled, and it's as long as you stayed off the sides, it was fine.
So, to your point about the role of the judge as a gatekeeper, let's assume that I was a trial judge on a medical malpractice case involving, say, neurosurgery, and so plaintiff would present an expert affidavit from a neurosurgeon, typically. But what if plaintiff presented an expert affidavit from a pediatrician?
Okay.
And I was in that role as a district court judge. I'm sure Judge Bjorkman was too. And I say that because I look at Ms. Lowe's CV, and where in the CV can I find the background and experience and training for her to be an expert with regard to this assault at a truck stop?
Okay.
Obviously, she would be qualified to testify as an expert on rehabilitation and the kinds of jobs that a person could seek. But so where on her CV can I find that information?
I think you can find that based upon her overall background in employment and placement, in her understanding of what jobs are, that's what she does overall. Your question is an interesting one, because it goes into medical malpractice, which has a pretty well-developed protection for doctors. I mean, the legislature's decided that doctors are protected more than a lot of defendants in any case whatsoever, other than governmental immunity.
Well, lot of other professions, you have to have an expert. So,
but
legal malpractice, architectural malpractice.
You're not required under the statute to have a expert in this case. I've been in front of this court arguing the issue on a couple of times that this is so straightforward, we shouldn't even need an expert. What happened when in Farnhorst, and I think I'm saying the name right, mm-hmm. Is it said that basically you need, for something like this, you need some sort of expert to come forward to say it. So it was added through the case law, not through the legislature. So it's not a situation where these employers are given the level of protection that an architect, a lawyer, or specifically to your question, a doctor's been given. So I don't know that to a plaintiff overall is a fair analogy. Because if there was that amount of specificity, we'd see more with that. Now, maybe what's going to come out of this case is we're going to find out that we're going to have even greater hurdles that we didn't have. Our argument is we had enough to go forward. That if a jury doesn't believe it, or if there was a full-blown Daubert hearing, You had a complete Daubert hearing where they came in, my client, my expert testified, we went through all the additional steps. Maybe, but I would submit that we had enough for a jury to make that determination. Now, they have that same CV you do. They can go to the jury and say, this woman has no ability to say anything. And then a jury can hear that and say, you know, you're right. But I would submit under the case law, under the what's developed with these types of cases, we have enough to get to that jury.
So
that would be my answer.
At the admissibility.
Sounds good. And maybe I could have shortened it by giving it that answer, Your
and
Honor.
So I just want to make sure I understand your argument then. So you're saying that we should not import professional liability, malpractice onto this kind of intentional tort.
That would be my argument, Your Honor. Now, like I've said, I've been here before in argument saying I don't think we even need an expert. We should be able to go to a jury and let a jury make this decision, that by even requiring the expert. But that's not the issue in this case because we did take the time. We did get an expert. I've worked with Jan for a long time, and she's not just going to say this just to say it because she gets paid to do it. She's not an ordinary medical examiner like you see some cases where, you know, they've got the same report over and over again. So I think there's a difference.
And you're just saying because she has worked with members of the truck, people who work in the trucking industry around vocational placement, work assessment, that she has enough of an understanding of that industry to be able to render a qualified opinion on the foreseeability of this particular.
Correct. That she provides enough foundation in her report that she feels like she could do it. I mean, that was the first question I asked her was, here's what I got. You think you can give me an opinion on that? And then she gave me the report. They've got the report. So we've got an affidavit from her saying these things. And I'd submit that's enough to get me by Farrenhorst. That's all that's required.
Although Farrendorf, as I recall.
Farrendorf, sorry.
That's right. These cases blend together. I mean, as I understand that case, it involved the sexual assault of a child in a daycare kind of setting.
Correct.
And you had an expert who was a child psychologist and had worked in a daycare setting. I mean, that seems to me an expert that has a bit more qualification than Jan Lowe does with respect to the foreseeability question here. Why am I wrong about that?
Well, it may be the nature of the actual tort itself. I mean, you know, I mean, you have thousands of instances of sexual abuse in daycares. You have a whole industry that's been created on both sides in dealing with those cases. You know, this kind of case with a truck driver assaulting another truck driver in Idaho doesn't happen very often. I mean, so the reality is I don't know that there's a ton of industry that's being created. I mean, if you had a bunch of these, you probably have an expert that I'm an expert in people getting beaten up by truck drivers. Is my answer. So I think those are different. Those are different types of cases is what I would, the difference I'd, but that in her affidavit and in her background, she's got enough to get us past that gatekeeper process for the court. That to me is the only thing that's important. Could she be better? Could it be perfect? I'd love that in cases. The more specific I can be, the better I can be, the better. You know, but
I expect if this case were to go to the jury, there would be a lot of discussion and the jury would be asked to decide the foreseeability question.
Well, it would be interesting on how the defense responds to that because arguably, they could do it in two ways. They could, one, just attack her on her CV and say she can't say these things and it doesn't happen. Or they could come up with an expert, and it'd be interesting to see what that expert's background is because I think that expert's going to be pretty much the same as Ms. Lowe in that there isn't a whole giant industry in dealing with these. So,
but there is some discussion in general that these incidents occur.
Correct.
And because of the particular work conditions under which these truckers function.
Sure, that it's not just single incident, correct. There is beyond that. But I think that how they respond to that would lead to an interesting issue with the trial both ways.
So let me ask you this. You seem to argue that you don't necessarily need an expert to get beyond, or do you think you need an expert to get to the jury on the issue of foreseeability?
Experience will tell me with the court to say that in my background and my history and what I've argued, no, I don't think you need an expert. But I accepted in this case I needed an expert. I went out and got an expert, and I dealt with, I believe, that hurdle. But to answer your question, I do believe you don't need an expert.
So if you don't need an expert, the district court said this expert isn't an expert. So that does that just put you back to, I don't need an expert, go to the jury?
No, I wouldn't get pushed back to that position. I that's my personal position and my belief, and that's what I would argue overall. But no, I would not get pushed back to that position. My position is I got an expert, she's a good expert, and she's enough to get me to a jury.
If I could, is there anything else in the record, the district court's record on the motion, besides the expert affidavit and the CV?
No, there was, other than the arguments, no, there was no additional items. Any other questions? And I'm glad I was able to get over here and say hi to you. So, thank you.
I think that might be my phone, and I was going to do that.
And turn it off, yeah, and I know we started a couple minutes early. That's okay. Why don't you turn it off? I appreciate that. Probably somebody trying to make sure you got here all right.
I apologize.
I was starting to wonder.
Counsel for responded. Just one of you are arguing today.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, you may proceed.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Tamara Novotny, and I, along with my co-counsel, Andrew Brown, represent Twin Express, Inc. And we are respectfully requesting that this court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment to Twin Express. The record reflects that the district court considered the applicable rules of civil procedure and rules of evidence and acted within her discretion when she found that Jan Lowe, a vocational consultant, was not qualified to provide an affidavit or an opinion as to whether assaults are a well-known hazard in the commercial trucking industry, and in turn found that plaintiff had failed to present sufficient evidence of foreseeability as needed to maintain a vicarious liability claim against Twin Express for its employees' intentional assault. Now, I think it's important to dispel at the outset what seems to be plaintiff's overall argument in their brief, which is that simply submitting an affidavit from some expert who's willing to say that certain conduct is a well-known hazard in an industry is enough to get to a trial on a vicarious liability claim. There is no authority out there that creates some exception to the basic competency and qualification requirements for witnesses or expert witnesses in vicarious liability cases.
Well, but here we have an expert who has experience working with truck drivers, right? I mean, she indicates as from a vocational perspective, but in that perspective, when you're making assessments about someone's ability to go back to work as a truck driver, for example, you're going to get some sort of knowledge about what that job is, what the pressures of the job, what the physical demands of the job is. So I don't understand why this expert is like categorically, you know, incompetent. I mean, because that seems to be your argument, that this is not the kind of expert who could opine, but why not? Why not with an expert who understands the job and then does some reading about things that have happened because of the conditions of that job around the country?
Ms. Lowe is certainly qualified as a vocational consultant, but as even counsel acknowledged and her CV reflects, that means dealing with things like placement issues, employability, wage loss issues. But she has never worked as a trucker, trained as a trucker, or been employed as a trucker, or any capacity with the trucking.
You say that somebody who worked as a trucker for 25 years and saw truckers get into scuffles at truck stops, that person could be an expert in this case?
I certainly think someone who's actually worked in the field and has that personal knowledge, that firsthand experience and that training, they would certainly be more qualified than Ms. Lowe is.
But didn't this was a motion for summary judgment, and the court, district court is required, kind of accept what's in front of the court and to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the party against whom the motion is brought. And here she says, I've got a lot of experience and knowledge in the trucking industry. So why shouldn't that be accepted at face value? Wasn't the court going beyond its role on a motion for summary judgment?
Not at all. The court was considering a motion for summary judgment, and part of the summary judgment rule is 5603D, which specifically requires that any affiant who is submitting a motion in support or opposition of a motion for summary judgment must have personal knowledge, and there must be some indication that they are competent to testify and address the matters that are set forth in their affidavit. So as part of the court's gatekeeping functions, the court has to look at any affidavit, whether it's Ms. Lowe or any other witness or a party affidavit, and consider, is this person someone who has personal knowledge and the basis to say what they're saying in this affidavit.
Basically, whether it would be admissible at trial.
Absolutely.
And why wouldn't, so I get to the point of why wouldn't Jan Lowe's testimony be admissible at trial? My concern is the court conflated the sort of, well, the court made a mistake in terms of going to the weight and the court's assessment of the weight of the testimony rather than its admissibility.
Well, I think the court was clearly looking at the qualifications. That was the very question that she asked counsel. Page 14 of the transcript, she said, tell me why Ms. Lowe is qualified to give the opinions that she is giving here. And she was obviously looking not only at the competency and the qualification requirements of Rule 56, but also looking at the Rule 702, which again specifically addresses expert testimony and whether they have the knowledge or the education or the experience to even get in front of a jury. And there was some discussion earlier about the Fahrendorf case. And the Fahrendorf case, the Supreme Court specifically discussed the requirements of what is now 5603D. And the court explained that, you know, affidavits can be found insufficient to raise a question of material fact if they're merely stating legal conclusions but don't provide a basis for the affiant's knowledge or make any showing as to why the affiant is competent to testify. And the Supreme Court in the Fahrendorf case then went on to look at the expert put forth there. And there the court noted this person had developed personal knowledge about the group home industry based on 23 years of actually working and managing group homes, which was the industry at issue. And so there the court said, yes, this person has the personal knowledge, they have the experience to provide these opinions, and they ultimately would be permitted to testify in front of a jury on these issues.
How do you respond to Mr. Bryant's argument that in this kind of case, he probably doesn't even need an expert to get to a jury?
Well, I guess I would disagree. I mean, generally the cases have made it pretty clear that generally, you need some evidence of foreseeability, and most often that comes forward in an expert opinion or in an expert affidavit.
Why can't we just know that from reading the paper or a jury? Why doesn't there's so much about road rage now?
Well, because there is case law. I believe it's the Freeler case. I might be mistaken. I know it's in our materials, but you cannot infer foreseeability. The courts have said that. So we can't infer it, and even in the Wilson versus Stock Lumber case, for example, this court had said, you know, just because we can imagine that something can happen. So maybe we've heard about road rage incidents, or we may have heard about assaults, or we can imagine a situation in which an assault might happen. That is not enough. That is not the standard. The courts have said you need to present some evidence of foreseeability. Now, does it always have to be an expert? No. That is usually the most common, the strongest, the most recognized means of establishing foreseeability. But there are also some cases where the courts have also considered the history of the particular defendant. You know, for example, does this particular defendant have a history of misconduct, assaults, and so on? Again, the court considered both of those in that Wilson case, the Buckles versus State case. The court also did consider the, you know, is there anything here about this particular defendant?
And we don't have that here, right?
Well, the court did consider that. I mean, the court considered both Ms. Lowe's affidavit, and they also considered whether there was anything with respect to Mr. Landis.
And there wasn't. That's my question.
Yeah,
I was trying
absolutely
to ask. There wasn't anything in this record that suggested that the conduct that occurred on this one occasion was foreseeable based on his past.
Correct. So in response to your question, would he absolutely need an expert? Maybe not if there was some additional evidence in Mr. Landis's background that they could come forward to explain why his conduct, this assault, was foreseeable and foreseeable to Twin Express to make them liable for his intentional action here.
So So thinking about the standard of review, typically we review a motion for a grant of summary judgment de novo, but here it's based on an evidentiary ruling that the expert wasn't qualified. So is it abuse of discretion, or how do you think we should, through what lens should we view this appeal?
I think absolutely it is an abuse of discretion standard. That is the question here, because the entire decision was founded on whether or not this expert affidavit was sufficient to establish foreseeability. So it is an abuse of discretion standard. And, you know, the courts, the cases make it quite clear that, especially when you're dealing with evidentiary issues, the expert qualification issues, there is great deference that's given to the trial courts on those issues. And even when the appellate courts may be inclined to view, you know, a proposed expert's qualifications a little bit more favorably, even the Supreme Court in the Gross versus Victoria Station case said, you know, even if we might view this a little bit differently, it's an abuse of discretion. There's great deference given to the trial court, and so we're not going to reverse the court on that basis.
Well, when was that case decided? The case
that was decided in 1998.
It seems to me our Supreme Court has signaled in many areas shift toward presenting more issues to juries rather than having the court. It seems like the court's gatekeeper role has shifted. That's maybe a better way to put it. I mean, what impact does that trend have on your argument?
That they're shifting more to juries? I mean,
that if it's a close question, and arguably the qualification maybe is close here, or whether this is foreseeable is close here, the close question of whether this goes to weight or admissibility. You know, I think in other contexts, close questions are going to the jury. Why is it
especially in the tort area?
Yeah. Why wouldn't we at least consider that in this case?
Well, I mean, as I think even plaintiff's counsel acknowledged, even if the court had not, you know, ruled as she did in this case, it wouldn't necessarily end the analysis. We would still potentially be bringing motions back before the court, challenging whether it's a Daubert hearing or something of that nature. Again, the court does have a gatekeeping function. I mean, Rule 5603D and Rule 702, they exist for a reason. You know, you don't just get to put anyone up there to provide opinions. Very clearly, the court has to consider, does this person get to come in? Do they get to come in and as an expert and to testify? And so perhaps there's some additional tendency to throw some things to a jury, but I don't think there's anything there that says the judge in its role as a trial court judge overseeing the evidence, the admissibility of evidence, who gets to testify and in what capacity. You know, the judge still has that role. They still have that function. Those rules do still exist. And again, we're not suggesting Ms. Lowe is not qualified as a vocational consultant. Had plaintiff put her forward to provide a report on whether Mr. Lowe could return to truck driving or, you know, would he need additional training to work in some other capacity, we wouldn't be challenging her on that basis. Now, we might cross-examine her when we get to trial, but that is not the reason she was being put forward in this situation. You know, we believe her opinion, consistent with the trial court, is completely outside of any of her work. I mean, a lot of professions work with a lot of other areas of employment. We're lawyers, right? You know, we represent truck drivers or nurses or lawyers or, you know, the local commercial retail store. It doesn't make me or any other attorney an expert to offer an opinion on every industry or every capacity of each industry that we may have worked with for the last 20 or 30 years. You know, you have to look at what is her education. You know, she is educated in music and in vocational rehabilitation counseling. What is her work entailed? Vocational consulting. What has her research been in? Marketing research, other than, for this case, going online and doing some Google research to find some articles, which is something anyone with access to the internet could do that same thing.
Well, but she does, though, as if we take her affidavit at face value, you know, she has extensive experience and knowledge pertaining to the trucking industry and the fields of employment. So Why wouldn't we really reasonably read that to say, she understands what a truck driver's job is and the physical and mental and other requirements of that job, and how is it such a big stretch then to say that she can opine based on her knowledge of the challenges that truckers face and the literature out there about the incidents of road rage? Why isn't that enough?
Well, first, I think the fact that she had to go do the Google research and find these articles suggests in and of itself that she doesn't have the personal knowledge, that firsthand experience that someone who truly is an expert
don't,
in
don't
this field.
Experts, and aren't they normally cross? I mean, they read books. They cite articles. You know, that's a common thing, isn't it?
They do, but they usually at least start out with some educational or experience background. They might be, you know, supplementing what they already know, and here instead it seems like she was going entirely to find some articles to support an opinion that she's being asked to provide. But, you know, her experience with truckers, and there's a difference between looking at trucking or the industry from a vocational standpoint. You know, you need to know the person has to have a CDL. They might have to be able to physically sit for hours at a time. Perhaps they need to be able to step up into a truck and be able to lift certain things. Those things you need to know as a vocational consultant to do her work, to provide the opinions that she normally does. There's nothing about that that says you need to understand, you know, assault, whether assaults occur within this industry, or to, you know, what are the behaviors well known to truck drivers. That is certainly, I think, well beyond her area of expertise.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bryant, you have the last word.
Great. And I've got a couple of issues based on things that have come up. I think what the Supreme Court has done is they've looked at this issue of facts, and if there's fact issues that clearly are fact issues, they said these should be something decided by the jury. That's what these case law, that's the loosening of the case law that we've seen over the last couple of years. And it's been easy for district court judges at times just to get rid of cases. They look at a case and they decide, I got a problem, and it gets dumped based upon this. Now, it's interesting because the defense's argument seems to be, follow this rule, but we could bring a bare motion. We could do something else, so it's easier to squish everything together and allow the court to do this under their discretion. That's not what the motion was. The motion was a summary judgment motion, and as was pointed out Your Honor, the judges supposed to accept the facts as they are in the summary judgment in favor of the person going forward. If you read page 6 of the judge's order, she says it was no evidence. A little bit later, she says there's no competent evidence. That might be one that you could look at. And then she says, absent any evidence, this is the decision that I make. I'd submit what we presented from Ms. Lowe is, in fact, evidence. It's admissible evidence, and it should go to a fact finder.
But it's admissible through the lens of Rule 702, right?
Correct.
And do you agree that we review that question for abuse of discretion?
Yeah, absolutely. It's discretion, and that was their argument. She had the discretion to do this. And I think from what I've heard, they're trying to do it in two ways. In one, she just had the discretion to look at it and throw it out, which I don't think she did. And to try to lump in another argument that says, well, we could bring a Dombert motion or we could bring other motions and deal with it. That's not fair. It's not fair to suddenly say this was really a different motion that requires other things and other things that can be done. I mean, in a Daubert motion, I can bring my Ms. Lowe in to testify. She can actually sit there and answer questions for the court on what she could do. That's different than a summary judgment motion. You don't have testimony in a summary judgment motion. And to compare affidavits that you get after the motion with the affidavit that we're putting forward saying this allows us to go forward under the case law, and I submit that we meet it. Again, going back to my original position, I don't think I even need it, okay? But the last point I'd like to make is this issue concerning what actually is the question here. The question here is there something that suggests an employer could have foreseeability? It's not, I don't think there's any issue this happened, okay? The question is, could an employer sitting there make a decision that says, this is possible, and based upon this, I have some liability on that? The courts have said you need to present something that says it's foreseeable. I got an expert that came in and says, she deals with employers, she deals with employees, based upon everything, it's foreseeable. I'd submit that gets me beyond this argument that there's no evidence, there's no competent evidence, there's absent any evidence. There's evidence there. There's admissible evidence, can be attacked in other ways, but that's not what we're here today with. And based upon that, I'd submit there's no question that this should be overturned and we should be allowed to continue on. Any other questions?
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you both for your helpful arguments. It's an interesting case. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.